Hi there, everyone, and welcome to the Escapist Movie Podcast. I am Jack Packard.
I'm Bob Chipman.
I'm Darren Rooney.
And this week we're going to talk The Devil All the Time and Antebellum, then discuss the Mandalorian trailer, and finally the big discussion of everyone moving when they're releasing their movies because we're still in a global pandemic. Hooray! So welcome. Come for the movies, stay for the terror. This is the Escapist Movie Podcast.
Starring three men who look like eggs.
It's so true. Anyway, on to the movie talk. First up, I know Darren and I have seen The Devil All the Time, the new Netflix original prestige genre drama... prestige, drama, character study, arty, farty.
He's trying to say depressing, folks.
It's one of
epic,
those...
epic, sweeping study of life in, Ohio? Between the Second World War and and Vietnam.
Yes.
Generational story of strife, struggle, suffering, angst, more suffering, maybe some religion thrown in there as well, possibly some pederasty. It's got everything.
Oh, it's got everything, and more importantly, Spider-Man and Batman get a couple scenes together. So it has a now all-star cast: Robert Pattinson, Tom Welling, but Holland. He was Superman. Tom Holland, Sebastian Shaw is in there. I said Sebastian Shaw.
Sebastian Shaw.
Which is something very different,
I think.
No, it's. I need to be corrected. I don't remember anything any of the time, so I need to be corrected when I'm making.
Oh, there are enough stars in here that you would understand if they get lost. It's got Tom Holland, Bill Sarsgaard, Robert Pattinson, Riley Keough, Jason Clarke, Sebastian Stan, Eliza Scanlon, Hayley Bennett. It's also got, I think, Mia Wasikowska in a small role as well, and Harry Melling, who is kind of coming up as the up and comer. I think he was Dudley in the Harry Potter movies,
yes. But
is now like the Coen brothers' favorite actor, which is one of those great career evolutions that I never would have called coming, but I guess this is 2020 and that's where we're at.
No, he's just a perfect, you know, he has that look to him where you can feel his psychosis oozing out of him. Beautiful actor. Way to go, Dudley. But yeah, it's not a, you know, it's not very plot heavy. This is a very character heavy study genre. Definitely something that Netflix probably wants to prop up for award season, as it just highlights all of their acting talent. Hoisted by its own prestige petard, I feel, at least, without getting into any spoilers. This is based off of a book by the same name, and instead of adapting the book, they have chosen to just put passages from the book as voiceover narration, even when showing the exact same thing that the voiceover is saying on screen.
Yeah, it's a weird movie in many ways. It kind of feels very much like it's aiming for this epic sweep, this kind of American Gothic, this study of kind of small town life and generational struggle, and this idea of kind of themes of cycles of violence. It's all very epic and very important and very worthy. It reminds me a lot, actually, of The Place Beyond the Pines, if you remember that movie from about 2012, starring Bradley Cooper and Ryan Gosling. Which I actually liked a great deal more than I liked this, but I think also suffered from a lot of the same problems, which is, if you're making a 2-hour-and-20 movie, it is very, very hard to tell a story of like literal generational strife. Gone with the Wind manages to do that, but that's like 4 hours long, and therefore you get the actual proper sense of the passage of time. Here in like The Devil All the Time, without getting too spoilery, like the main character is played by Tom Holland. That's not a spoiler. And you spend a bit of time before you meet Tom Holland with his father, who's played by Bill Skarsgård. So you spend the first half hour of a 2-hour-and-20-minute film with a completely different actor and a completely different character. And the idea is, you know, understandably thematically, the idea is like, oh, well, we're going to learn why the character is the way that he is. We're going to learn that, you know, the son inherited things from the father. The son is the way that he is because of things that the father did. Mm-hmm. But in terms of like structuring a 2-hour-and-20-minute movie, it means that you're watching Bill Sarsgaard, you're invested in Bill Sarsgaard, and then you're like, hey, where's Bill Sarsgaard? And I think that, like, without being too mean or too unfair to you know, Tom Holland. And I mean, I will be mean and unfair, maybe a little bit to Robert Pattinson and Sebastian Stan in a moment, who are acting so hard, they have potches. Like, that's how you can tell that this is a serious movie. We got, like, the comic book actors, and they have stomachs. And that's how
Sebastian
seriously we're taking
even
this.
Put, like, cotton in his mouth to give him puffy cheeks. Beautiful.
That proper Marlon Brando. That, yes. Like, again, there's a real take us seriously. Now, to be fair, Stan, I do not like Stan here. Stan is very much doing the take me serious as an actor thing. Mm-hmm. Pattinson, who, to be fair to him, has actually put in the legwork and has spent a decade, like, being taken serious as an actor, has arrived on the set of this Southern Gothic and has just decided, I'm going to eat on all the scenery. Like, Pattinson knows the level that this kind of melodrama is pitched at, and he just arrives and he feasts. There's a moment where, like, Pattinson's character arrives, the locals have laid out, like, a literal kind of feast for him, a banquet for him to eat at, chicken wings, corn on the cob, all the local delicacies, and instead Pattinson takes one look and he says, no, I'm going to stand here and deliver a speech for the ages. And, you know, I can respect that, because more than any other performer in the movie, Pattinson seems to at least understand the movie that he's in. And I mean, I like Holland. Yes. I think Holland is an incredibly talented young actor. I'm really looking forward to seeing him in Cherry from the Rousseau brothers later on, which will be a real kind of like push his legs. I think he was very good in Pilgrimage, which is a little scene independent movie, which was shot in Ireland. I think Holland was very, very good in that role there. So I'm not at all disparaging him as an actor. I just think that like he doesn't really work here in large part because this is a generational saga and Tom Holland always looks 12. So you don't really get that sense of the epic sweep of history around him. Mm. And there's also the fact that, like, this is a... And again, Jack kind of alluded to it. This is a very earnest, sincere, like, gritty movie about human suffering and angst, you know? And there's a lot of stuff that happens in here that is very heavy. But the problem is that, like, if you're making a movie like that, you need a cast that can brood. And, like, I like Tom Holland a lot, but his core strength, he is not a good brooder. And particularly when he's following, like, Bill Sarsgaard, who is pretty good as brooding goes, you feel like you're kind of taken a step down. I actually feel like if you cast, say, Timothée Chalamet as, like, young, handsome actors go, Chalamet is a better brooder, I think, than Holland. Holland just has too much of a kind of a joy de vivre. So when he's kind of angsting and kind of, like, reflecting, I don't really buy it. And so as a result, the whole movie kind of feels
when
off,
he's,
I think.
When he's playing off of Eliza Scanlon, who does a fantastic job as just, you know, the Debbie Downer, if you will. Like, she's just forever beaten. Also, you know, sins of the father, sins of the parents weighing on her. Like, she embodies that character in a way that you can tell Tom Holland is trying to, but when they play off of each other, there is a clear heavyweight there.
Yeah, and it's rather unfortunate as well, because, like, I mean, one of the things that slightly bothers me about the movie, and I think it's a structural mistake, and I kind of wonder if I haven't read the book. I'm not going to pretend I've read the book. But, like, after it was over, I was like, man, this story would work so much better as a novel. And I was like, ha, quick Google. I was like, yeah, that paid off. But it also, like, it would probably work better as a prestige television show, which is where a lot of kind of the middle brow kind of cinema's gone, where you have, like, 8 episodes with this cast, and therefore you get time to develop and expand them. I don't know about you, Jack, but you mentioned Eliza Scanlon there. I think she's phenomenal here. And the issue with the movie for me is that, like, you have, on the one hand, you have, like, the A-list cast members. So Sebastian Stan, Robert Pattinson, and Tom Holland. And I think that Pattinson comes out the best of those three. But each of them are kind of knocked off the screen by actors who get much less to do in the movie. So I think, like, I quite liked you mentioned Dudley from Harry Potter, who has a relatively small role here, but is almost perfectly cast in that tiny role. You mentioned Eliza Scanlon, who is primarily there to serve as, like, emotional kind of leverage or angst on Tom Holland's character and doesn't get much to do as well. Mia Wasikowska, who is one of the great actors of the past decade, but who seems to have largely disappeared. She is in a tiny role in this movie, and I would like to have spent more time with her. So I think, like, I think there's a weird waiting that goes on in terms of compressing it into 2 hours and 20 minutes that just, it doesn't serve the movie well.
No, and also structurally speaking, like I mentioned before, and I think, you know what, I think you can include Skarsgård as a heavyweight who also does a fantastic job in his role. You know, he fully embodies his role as Tom Holland's father. But the other thing is this heavy-handed messaging that either the filmmakers didn't trust in themselves to tell the story correctly, or they didn't trust the audience to get it. You know, like, there are basically, it's all sins of the father theming wise, you know, the generational burdens and the sons or the daughters repeating the mistakes of their parents. It's very, very heavy-handedly themed. And then you add that voiceover narration that literally, at one point, I had to write this down. At one point, the voiceover narration literally says, "like her mother years ago." As if we didn't already get that.
Oh, no, there's a moment where, like, the folksy kind of, like, again, the kind of narration that was parodied in The Big Lebowski, but delivered earnestly here, where it's like, Tom realized there was a violence inside of him, like his father before him. He thought maybe he should go to war, but then he realized he had been at war all along. And it's like, wow, that is a profound theme. If only you had shown me that or communicated that to me through your storytelling, rather than like just dropping it on me and expecting me to go, yep, that's pretty deep movie. I really, really appreciate it. It's kind of interesting. You mentioned this as kind of like a prestige drama piece. I think it's notable that Netflix are releasing this now, that like this is the opening salvo of Netflix's kind of awards thing, because this is very much a kind of a, watching it, it feels like a clear the plate move. Where it's like, okay, we still have, like, Mank from David Fincher about, like, the making of Citizen Kane starring Gary Oldman. That's our ace in the hole. That's going to be the one that's going to pick up all the awards traction, the great reviews. Let's just sneak this one out there as early as possible. It kind of, like, reminds me a bit of The King. If you remember The King from last year with Timothée Chalamet. Oscar-worthy brooding. Again, some wonderful brooding there. Like, The King, I don't think it's a great movie, but I actually enjoyed it more than I enjoyed this, in large part because it seemed to understand what it was, and it seemed to be aware of what it was doing, and it seemed to lean into the parts of itself that were stronger, as opposed to this, which is, it's hard to, like, we've talked a lot around it, and it's just like, well, we can tell you what the movie's told us it's about, but it's really just a mess.
It really is. But I do like that idea that the devil all the time is like an hors d'oeuvre. Like this is getting your palate ready for the good movies, that the good prestige dramas that will come out later in the year. Like, just get ready, warm up. And it's very palatable. It's there's nothing like, besides the voiceover, there's nothing egregiously wrong with the movie. The structure's off, but it's very pleasant to watch. It's good actors doing drama well. But
I do actually have to admit,
I'm now
you've made me want to watch it. Like, I mean, I was going to, I was going to watch it anyway, because like it's, I probably like could have squeezed in, especially have either of your Netflixes updated with the thing that speeds the time? Because like, because I haven't done, like I haven't done it, because I haven't done it yet, because like it feels wrong to do, but like I would have.
It feels like a cheat.
Yeah, it feels cheating, but because here's the thing, I might have squeezed it in. I hadn't heard that they had done the voiceover thing yet, and that sounds so hilariously inappropriate to the material.
Yes.
Because like when you said like, oh, it's got a heavy-handed about the moral. Mm-hmm. I mean, granted, this book was a few years ago. What moral? There's not much to this. Is, I mean, I have to, like, I don't know when I'm going to get the opportunity about one of these again. I need to ask someone actually from Ireland what it's like watching Americans attempt, because we do this once in a while, working in the genre that is essentially, as far as I understand it, like the chief fiction export of the nation of Ireland, from our experience on this side, which is, you know, very long intergenerational stories of working class misery. And I could be wrong about this, because my other friends who are from Ireland, of which there are not a lot, but some, because I don't get to Ireland ever because I'm poor. You know, I assure me that there is other popular culture, but what we get over here exported to us in the form of books and films generally comes in the form of, you know, dad was poor, ma was poor. She had 12 kids, 14 died, and then they foreclosed on the farm. And that's every Irish book that I know of that gets sent here. So I know there must be more. And it seems like movies and books and films like this are our like attempt at this. We make a lot of them. And other than The Grapes of Wrath many, many, many years ago, almost all of them are, like, we think we're supposed to be good at this. We're actually not. Like, yeah, America is a cheerleader country. We are not good at grappling with our own misery.
That's true.
We aren't an introspective people.
There was only Steinbeck and no one else. Absolutely.
But it kind of, like, it's a funny Bob should mention that, because it does actually feel, and again, this is probably the thing where, you know, I am not an American, so I don't want to talk about America in, like, absolute terms or anything like that.
Oh, please do.
Generalize the hell out of it. But one of the things is that, like, America often feels like it's several different countries at the same time, largely because you are so much larger than us. You know, and we consider ourselves to be at least three different countries in terms of, like, identity and where you're from. Mm-hmm. So watching The Devil All the Time, and it's funny Bob should mention this, because, like, a large part of what those stories that are, you know, those sad stories about generational woe, which we largely bring out at kind of football games and sing in a weirdly cheery, upbeat manner for ourselves, but we export as the fields of Athenry, and they shot him, and they murdered his family, and they moved him out to Australia. Now go beat the other team! But yeah, you have kind of, like, if you've ever been in a stadium of, like, Irish people who are, like, not, again, another stereotype of Irish people. Irish people are generally, like, relatively well-adjusted and kind of, like, polite and friendly and kind of, like, nice people. But if you've ever been in a stadium with them singing the Irish national anthem, it gets proper intense. Soldiers of destiny crossing the ocean. But it's the thing with that, though, is what Bob mentioned, that kind of, like, sad poverty, kind of, like, angsty, like, well, we had a tough life. Ma died in bed, and Dad, well, he was a mad one for the drink. That sort of stuff we tend to export for other people, and so it kind of looks weird when we watch it ourselves. And The Devil All the Time feels a little bit like that when I'm watching it, because it feels like nobody who has ever been, and again, I haven't been to Ohio, but it has the texture of something made by somebody who has never been to the place where it's set, but has, like, read a lot of books about it, seen some old photos of it, and maybe read some John Steinbeck and been like, I can do that. I can make that work. Because it does have that kind of, like, almost, you know, anthropological kind of aspect to it, where it's like, people who live in, I think it's Knockham Stiff is the name of the town in Ohio where the book of the action unfolds. People who live in Knockham Stiff must be very eccentric forces. I mean, like, again, and I'm wary of putting spoilers in here, so if we can do the little, like, nice little spoiler tag down here.
That's right, spoilers are coming up for The Devil All the Time. Go to the 21-minute mark to skip them all. Huzzah!
There's, like, not one but two sequences in this film where a character's journey is interrupted by the fact that they are picked up hitchhiking by a bunch of random serial killers who just happen to know everybody else in the same story being told. It reminds you a lot of, you remember Denis Villeneuve's Prisoners, which seemed to take place in, like, the child molestation capital of the world, where, like, every character was either a victim, a perpetrator, or a cop, and you couldn't throw a stone without finding somebody involved in some sort of horrible, grotesque act. But, like, Prisoners was, like, a genre piece. Sorry.
That's the most plausible thing that happens in Prisoners, though.
That is it exactly. Yeah, no, like, the only way Prisoners make sense is if you assume the entire movie takes place, like, in a community that has been formed explicitly, like, to house sex offenders. Yeah. Because it's like, oh no, maybe it was the other sex offender who lives near. No, 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 it was the other guy. Okay, well, that's grand.
No, but you
like,
a
The
really...
Devil All the Time is like The Devil All the Time is very much like that, but, like, wants you to take it seriously. The Devil All the Time is like, yes, but what if there were a whole bunch of murderers living, like, within stone's throw of one another, but this was a serious drama about generational struggle and an exploration of, like, the violence in American character.
And that's the other really infuriating thing about the movie, which I know I already called palatable, which it is...
It looks beautiful. It does.
It looks,
like,
beautiful.
Crowley cinematography is stunning. Yeah.
Great, great. But and we're in spoiler territory now, so it's okay to say this, but at the end of the film, all of our disparate characters get together, and that's fine, that's a normal thing that happens. The only problem is, they laid out that thesis statement in one of the opening voiceover dialogues, where they say, oh, these people, we might not see them for a while, but they sure are gonna come back later and be important, don't worry. Like, and that is how the voiceover sounds too. Like, these people, it's funny how life interwines with each other. And it's like, fuck, come on, let us discover something about the movie.
My favorite.
That's not actually funny. That's just a thing that happens.
Yeah. My favorite part is the bit where they're like, Carl and Sandy met up. And soon they'd be murdering random strangers on the side of the road. But we won't be talking about that for a little while. So let's get back to the story of Willard Russell.
We won't talk about that until 45 minutes into this movie that you're watching. Like, you, we appreciate you watching. And make sure to resubscribe to your Netflix subscription. Yeah.
And like Jack mentioned, the end where they all come together. Like, it's really odd because it's like a sorting, it's like a Netflix sorting algorithm of like famous actors, where like all the characters in the movie are cast by famous actors. So they have to be like sorted and come into contact with one another. And then one of them gets defeated. And then, oh, another character comes in contact. And then that character gets defeated. And then it's like, no, wait, this third character is coming. It's like, oh no, he got defeated. I guess our character gets to level up and get to the like thesis statement delivered by narration.
Yes. And so it's... It wasn't, you know, like I was all primed and ready for some prestige drama. I keep wanting to say genre. I was all primed and ready for some prestige drama, and it definitely fell flat only by its own. Like I said, I think a lot of this when filmmakers overuse voiceover or just like ham-fistedly shove their thesis statement in front of the camera is either a lack of trust in themselves or a lack of trust in the audience to understand what they're making. And so hopefully this is a stepping stone for the filmmakers to figure out what they want to say and how they want to say it.
Well, it's Antonio Campos who directed, I think, Christine, which I actually quite liked a few years ago, the one with Rebecca Hall, about the news reporter who famously committed suicide on air. It was a little bit of an indie prestige darling. It's well worth seeking out. I thought it was much better than this. I will say I've been very mean about this movie. I feel like I've been a little bit too mean about this movie. I will say it does look gorgeous. Mm-hmm. The soundtrack is lovely. And I kind of admire its ambition and how much it goes for what it's going for. And I do have a soft spot. Like, again, maybe this is just as an Irish person. And you mentioned the idea of like looking out at another culture. I have a bit of a soft spot for like that kind of moody American Gothic. When it's done well, it is not done well here. But even when it's not done well, it's still kind of like fascinating because it feels like the kind of movie that they usually make about, you know, sort of people in England or Britain or sort of, you know, or foreign countries. And it's kind of interesting to see it applied here, even though I don't think it works at all.
Yeah, we when it's good because these are very interesting, because I mean, this is a really big country. And what's deceptive about it is that it's a lot of land, but not that much of it has people on it. Yeah. as you would think. Yeah. And so there's very small like communities of it, and there's interesting little cultures in it. And the Winter's Bone is actually a really good version of this kind of thing, but it doesn't try to be like sweeping and intergenerational. It's like too generational. It's like there's, hey, something bad happened with my father. Eventually I'm going to deal with it. And that's kind of it.
Yeah.
That's kind of it. And like, that's the good version of that. Mm-hmm. That's pretty good. Yeah.
I think, Darren, you hit on it earlier where you said it seemed like the filmmakers like romanticize this part of the South, but had never been there. It definitely had that touristy vibe, you know, like poverty tourism. And so, you know,
that's another thing. Yeah.
And so like that could have been another reason why it fell flat. But, you know,
and I think also like the serial killer stuff as well. It's like people are sure weird in these places, which is very like it's a weird, like, imagine like traveling to Ohio where there's like two serial killers for every 10 people. It's like, it's a really weird kind of like view that they have of how things work in that part. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not saying, I mean, again, like, it's worth noting that one of the big prestige Irish movies a couple of years ago was like, which sold really well internationally, was a Calvary, which starring Brendan Gleeson as a priest. And I think the moment that literally every Irish person called bullshit on that movie was when they cast Donald Gleeson, who is great, as like a cannibalistic serial killer in rural Sligo. And it was like, ha! If there was a cannibalistic serial killer in rural Sligo, we would never shut up talking about him. You would never hear the fucking end of it. It would be the most interesting thing to have happened in rural Sligo in like three generations. So it feels a little like, again, I don't want to generalize about Ohio and knock 'em stiff, but I do wonder if like, there's a little bit of that at play here.
All right. Well, let's move on to Antebellum. Unfortunately, only Bob has had to see it, but I know both Darren and I are interested in your thoughts in pitching us this movie.
Okay. I will avoid spoilering as much as possible.
We appreciate that.
Because, well, then, you know, my colleagues have not seen it. And I think, I mean, this has been out, I think, for 2 weeks in France, parts of Europe. It might be out in the UK. I'm not sure. But it's been out in places, or at least it's shown in festivals throughout Europe. It's about to go premium video on demand, I think, everywhere or most everywhere in the West this coming Friday. I don't know about anywhere else. That's where it is in the U.S. at least. This was supposed to be out now at the same time in theaters. Obviously, that's not happening. So they just put it out. This is the same producers as Get Out and Us, but it is not a Jordan Peele movie.
Mm-hmm.
This is done by I don't have the paper in front of me, but their names are Bush and Renzi, are their first and last name. They are a couple. They are two directors. They're co-writer, co-directors. Christopher Renzi is one guy's name, and the other gentleman's name is...
Jared Bush?
Jared Bush.
Jared Bush, yeah.
And they've done short films, mostly political activism, and they did 17, the Trayvon Martin short, that got a lot of attention a little while back. This has Janelle Monáe, isn't it? She's the lead star. And, you know, whatever else you can say about this movie, this is basically like a huge showcase for, you know, if you thought she could do everything in music and dance, turns out she can also, like, run the acting decathlon. You know, as so, it's there because, yeah.
What's the pitch? What's the movie about? Let's start there.
That's sort of the thing is that like it's literally the plot of the movie would be spoiling the movie. So yeah, so like it's like the trailers for the movie are out of context shot, out of context shot, out of context shot. What is that thing? So, I think what I can say about the movie is that there are sequences of the film which appear to take place in the antebellum South, where Janelle Monáe is playing a slave on a southern plantation that is particularly brutal and is being overseen by Confederate soldiers instead of farmers. And things just aren't quite right there. And then there are other portions of the movie which are to take place in the 20th century, where Janelle Monáe is playing a completely different character with a completely different personality, a completely different name, who is a famous lecturer who lectures on social justice issues, who is touring to promote one of her books.
Feel how hard it is not to spoil anything, and that makes me excited to see it.
Yeah, well, and the thing is, as I'm describing that, you know, there are parts of, there's basically three, it's a three-act film, it's 90 minutes long, and it has three exact, more or less exactly 30-minute halves. One half is, you know, this is, we're in 1860s. Now we're in 2020, and then there's a third half, which is so it's yeah. So and they've I think it's a really interesting. It has a lot of big ideas in it. It takes really, really big swings. I don't know that all of the big swings get over the fence, but I think it gets all the runners home.
Okay.
Is would be the baseball metaphor. I don't understand
any of this.
Okay.
I'm kidding. I'm going to assume most of our listeners do.
You know, I think it is literally impossible to get kind of close to explaining like the, even like the plot mechanics, because like literally, if you haven't seen the trailer for it, if you've watched the trailer, I think most people who watch the trailer will pretty much guess, oh, okay, I think I know what's going on here. Mm-hmm. But it's gonna, I don't know that they originally wrote it to have a twist, because it kind of has like 12 successive twists in the sense of, okay, all right, here's what's going on. Uh-huh. Okay, what's going on is a
more
twist.
More just developments, yeah. Okay, more just wait. Developments than twists.
Yeah. Right. And like, okay, what's going on is a twist, but why? And to what purpose? for who, through what means, and et cetera, et cetera. So I think if I have an overall criticism of it, mm-hmm. is it would be more interesting if, not more interesting, it would be more watchable, like on second way through, if they had just said up front, okay, no, this is what the story's about, here's what's going on, and then just played it through. Mm-hmm. As opposed to making two parts of a basically three-part story have to continue going, here's almost what's going on, here's almost what's going on, like to if it's there's a lot of sleight of hand going on.
Yeah,
sure.
And as a result, like once it gets to, hey, here's what's going on and here's what has to be done about it, and it's like, all right, hell yeah, all right, cool, I'm on board, yeah. And it kind of gets there and I'm like, hell yeah, all right, cool, good. And and also I kind of like turned out that I was right about what I guessed that it was about, so I was on board anyway. But it's really interesting. It's got a lot of like interesting ideas. It's a tough watch in parts because, and I think this is sort of like another mistake to it, is that they, for something that wants to end up as a big crowd pleaser, as in the kind of sends the audience home going, yeah, all right, cool, I like her, she's awesome, cool. It spends an awful lot of time reminding us why slavery was bad and bad for black women in particular in really unflinching upfront. It really wants to, if not for the trailers, which everyone and their mother has seen if they've like heard of this movie on TV, mm-hmm. you know, if you just stumbled upon this for 30 minutes, you would think you were watching an Academy Award bait slavery movie.
12 Years a Slave.
Right, yeah, for mm-hmm. how graphic and, you know, unrelentingly, you know, show this in school on during February slavery sure. movie it is. Mm-hmm. And then there's a succession of twists that kind of transform it into something else entirely. I'm not sure that front-loading the movie in that kind of, like, as, and I'll steal from my own review, like, Schindler's List and Inglourious Basterds are both good movies. I don't know they're supposed to be the same movie.
Yeah. Ooh. Okay, no,
starting
you just
with
sold
Schindler's
me on
List
watching
and ending
the movie.
With Inglourious Basterds, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That really sells me on watching and seeing how they fit the pieces together though.
And I'm not saying that like it's exactly that, but like tonally I'm not sure that that's like I'm not sure that like the tonally that kind of like clicks in, but it's really interesting to go with. The reason to watch it would be Janelle Monáe basically play 2.5 different characters, and she's really good. Like she plays like the straight, like, you know, 1860s person who was a slave. Mm-hmm. Very realistically, it's a like powerful, straight, dramatic performance. Very intense stuff. For purposes of plot, she doesn't speak a whole lot, which is, you know, an interesting thing to do for someone who's basically known for singing.
Yeah.
To say, okay, here's your silent performance, go for it, and she does. And, you know, then, you know, the 21st century part of the movie is all, you know, obviously the audience is supposed to be going, okay, hold on, wait, what the hell's going on here? But as far as she knows, she's in a dramedy about a professional woman going out on the town, and she's, like, great. Mm-hmm. And then she's, like, doing a whole action hero thing towards the back half of the film, and it turns out she can also do that. So, like, put her in all the things. She's magnificent. It's got a great Jack Huston performance. He turns out to be really good at just being a complete bastard. Like, I don't know that it totally works, but it is so much more interesting and compelling and unusual than a lot of things that are less flawed. And it's doing the politics of this, once people have seen it, are going to be fascinating to pick over. Mm-hmm. Because it's kind of got like one level where it's very simple and it's like, hey, by the way, racists, bad people, killing, you know, beating the shit out of them very, very violently, fun for the whole family. You know, that's like this is a very one side. This is not a, you know, maybe we can talk this out. This is more of a no. This is more of a stab, shoot, kill, destroy movie about that.
Great.
But, yeah, I like that. But it's also got a very, like, as her character goes, there's a very sort of interesting angle on what it views her, on where she is coming from, and what is supposed to make her the hero of this particular story. Like, what, why is she the strong person in this particular story that is much different from what is supposed, what the usual version of this kind of thing. It is really hard to do this without mentioning anything whatsoever. Yeah, it's
by next week. Both Darren and I can see it, and then we'll do a spoiler cast about it. Absolutely.
But bizarre and recommended. So yeah,
I like all you have said has absolutely sold me on it. Absolutely.
Okay. All right.
Great. You did a much better job with that than we did with The Devil All the Time.
But now I'm going to watch that, though. Possibly on 2x speed, but I'm going to watch it.
You know, maybe just 1.5. You know, that'll...
Yeah.
I kind of like... I wonder if, like, watching it slowly, though, is part of the charm and inverted commas of it. Like, the long... You know those familiar shots of kind of, like, chasing cars down these long, winding country roads and stuff? Feel like if you're skipping that stuff, then are you skipping the good part of The Devil All the Time? Darren continues to sell The Devil All the Time really well.
I want to be supportive of Tom Holland. I do. I feel bad for the fact that he is like one of these guys who's like stuck in his adolescence and it's not his fault. Mm-hmm. And I feel especially bad because I keep forgetting that he's English and he seems to be one of the only two English actors with this problem. Like, that's usually an American affliction, but him and Taron Egerton both seem to have like contracted that American genetic virus, where as old and legitimately like tough as they get, they're still stuck youthful, especially Edgerton, who's actually a big lad, you know, but like he always looks like a little baby man, and it's unfortunate for him. Like, he's actually like a kind of like a big strapping football kind of guy, but like take him out of the Kingsman movies and he looks like a little boy, and it's so sad. He's gonna be a little boy until he's like 50, and like he should look like Brendan Gleeson by now with all of these action things that he does, and it's not happening for him, and it's very unfortunate.
It's worse for Tom Holland in The Devil All the Time because he is playing, you know, like a impoverished person. He's always wearing like clothes that are too big for him, so he always looks like he's wearing daddy's clothes.
I mean, good that they found him Spider-Man, because, you know, finally we have a Peter Parker who literally can stay 15 forever, like they've always wanted. You know, they're not gonna like be stuck with Tobey Maguire's male pattern baldness and, well, all of the other Tobey Maguire stuff, but that's another show.
All right. Well, then we can move on with ease. Let's ease into The Mandalorian. They have released the trailer for season 2 of The Mandalorian, which is coming out in October?
October 30th or 31st, I think. It's either Halloween or the day before Halloween. Expect the day before, because Halloween is a Saturday.
Okay, October 30th on Disney Plus, the season 2 of The Mandalorian drops. The trailer for me, I'll start off, looks like more of the same, which I will say is an okay thing because the first season was okay.
I feel like there's not really much for me personally to bounce off there. I like The Mandalorian. I think it's extraordinarily well produced. I think it's very well cast. I think it's made by people who love what they're doing. I think it's incredibly pleasant and easy to watch. I think the fact that I talk about those things in that way makes it sound like I'm denigrating them. I am not. It is very hard to make something that is that pleasant to watch and that inoffensive, and that people genuinely love and get so much out of. And particularly when you're talking about a Star Wars fan base, which, if we're being honest, you know, could probably pick a fight with their own mother. I think that, like, making something that seems to genuinely make them happy is an accomplishment that, like, deserves to be lauded from the, you know, the balcony, basically. And I think that Favreau, like Favreau a lot, and I think that it's good that, you know, he settled into this niche where, well, he made Chef. That was his, like, big artistic ambition. Now he's going to get paid, and he's going to get paid to do what he wants to do. And it's like, okay, I can't really begrudge Favreau that, because I think was the joke on Family Guy, he seems like the kind of guy who would move your couch if you asked him to. It's really that hard to object to him. I would like it if Disney were doing something at the same time as The Mandalorian that was a bit more ambitious, a bit more out there, a bit more pushing the boundaries of what Star Wars was, because The Mandalorian is very much, here is the Star Wars you remember. And I think that's great. I think, like, a large part of using an established intellectual property is saying, well, you like this thing because you like this other thing, so they should be comparable to one another. But I do find myself sometimes wishing that, like, this is, like, a really good Force Awakens. Maybe we could see a bit more of The Last Jedi happening at the same time, and then everybody would be happy.
That's where I'd actually argue with you, where I think this does take more from The Last Jedi than The Force Awakens, specifically because there's no freaking Skywalkers in it. Like, yes, we have a Baby Yoda. Yes, we have a Mandalorian. Everyone likes both.
And an ice planet and a sand planet and, you know, Tusken Raiders and Tatooine.
And that's all, fine, but I think they pushed the boundaries in the fact that they decided to make something just simple, genre, space cowboy. That's what we're doing. Lone Wolf and Cub, that's what we're doing. We're not trying to, you know, if Baby Yoda turns out to be the granddaughter of Rey or whoever, whenever this takes place, then that's when people will get upset. Mm. So I applaud them for their simplicity.
Yeah, I was really, 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 really skeptical about The Mandalorian going into. And the thing is, I was really, really skeptical about it because it looked like exactly what I wanted. And when it comes to Star Wars, I have taught myself to fear that. And I have taught myself to fear that, like that is, like, the part of Star Wars when I look at it and I go, yes, want, that's to me, that's my version of, like, the depression shadow monster. Like, I was like, no, you're unhealthy. I know that you're here, and I know you're always going to be here, but you're an unhealthy instinct and influence in my life, so I'm always going to question you, because you are the thing that gets mad when Luke throws the lightsaber away, and that was a smart thing. So you're wrong. So I have to be questioning of this.
Yes.
But when the trailer for the first season of Mandalorian comes out, and we're going, okay, do you want this? Here's what we're giving you. It's power armor Boba Fett. And he's going to do nothing but chase aliens around. Mm-hmm. And he's going to go to all the Star Wars places you like. And he's going to do all the Star Wars stuff you like. And it's just going to be action figures talking to other action figures. And that's going to be it. And that's all it is. And we're going to do it. And we're going to make a Lone Wolf and Cub ripoff with it, because we know you like samurai stuff. And there's only two that you've heard of, and that's one of them. So there you, and we can't do Ninja Scroll, so this is it. And there you go. And that they're going to, like, it was like the most panderific thing they could possibly come. It's like, look, it's the robot from behind the bar, and he's shooting people. He's a robot made of guns. Yeah. And I'm thinking, okay, fine, cool. Okay, just bring out this fan pandering thing because you're trying to apologize to people for the good movie that you made this time. Okay, fine, throw it out. And then they drop it out, and it's like, oh yeah, actually, we fooled you. This is about a sensitive soft boy who's going to push a baby carriage around for 13 episodes. And I went, okay.
But okay, they still managed to get all of that other stuff in.
And they did. And not only that, it's not actually the Star Wars that you remember. It's the first time that they've actually went and shot the Star Wars that people think they remember. Yeah. This isn't A New Hope, memory. And it's not Empire Strikes Back. It's kind of Return of the Jedi. It's most, this is the first Star Wars that's mostly made to look like the lunchbox. It's a lot of aliens packed into a tight place, and they fly spaceships around, and guys pull lightsabers out of their ass, and it's a reference to something from one of the damn books, and sometimes it's a little goofy, and most of the people are aliens, and it's the start, like, before you could just put in the tape and watch it all the time, which, I mean, predates me, so I'm just, like, going off of received sense memory here. But, like, this is Star Wars when you fought back and remember mostly just the planes flying at the Death Star and the cantina scene and some stuff in between. And it's kind of cool, and it works, and they got good character stuff into it. And holy shit, they did a good job.
Sounding so surprised, Bob. How
can I not be surprised? I saw the third movie that they made based on the same instincts, and it's spending more money than they spent on the entirety of this show, and it's like not a third as good as this show is. And I didn't mind the third movie. I thought, okay, but under the circumstances, i.e. the character that you were clearly planning to base most of this movie around died before you shot it, and you had to make, you know, do with something else, and you're trying to apologize for a movie that you know very well you shouldn't be apologizing for. Like, they did... But this is pretty good. Like, I mean, they even had Giancarlo Esposito pulls out the black lightsaber thing to like make a reference to one of the cartoons specifically, so that like 12 people watching the show at the same time will all go ee, and I didn't care that was a reference to something, because I guess hey, that looks kind of cool. Yeah. All right, yeah, I'm with it. I'm for it. Let's do it.
Absolutely.
I think Bob undersells, like, The Mandalorian. I like The Mandalorian less than Bob, but it is far more than three times as good as The Rise of Skywalker. even as somebody who isn't necessarily drawn into it, it is incredibly well produced and made by people who clearly love what they're doing, and that bleeds through into every single frame of it. And, like, I am glad that it exists. I'm glad the people working on it love it. I'm glad the people watching it love it as well. Like, I mean, you know, and I think, yeah, that is a... That alone gets it more than three times, I think, further than The Rise of Skywalker on any metric.
Well, then I think, like, Bob, you're very correct in, like, that it pulls from the same feeling that we had when we were younger watching Star Wars. I know this is something I've talked about on other shows here at The Escapist. Doom 2016, The Legend of Zelda, The Breath of the Wild do very similar things where, you know, they're basically kind of reboots, or people say that, oh, like, this harkens back to the old way that I used to play the original Legend of Zelda or the original Doom, even though they're nothing like the originals. They just invoke that same feeling. And so that's the great trick that The Mandalorian does. And it, you know, not only panders to Star Wars fans, but it has appealed to everyone across the board, mostly because of Baby Yoda. Thank you, Werner Herzog, for making them make it a puppet. Theoretically, yeah, it's been rumored that he said, "Use the puppet, you coward."
Werner Herzog's press tour for The Mandalorian.
I believe it.
Werner Herzog's press tour for The Mandalorian is the best thing that Disney's Star Wars have produced. And I mean, I like The Last Jedi, and I also respect this as well. But like him talking he didn't realize that it was a puppet, that it was like the moment he realized that it was being operated by people using remote controls, a little bit of Werner Herzog, you know, the darkest man in show business with the blackest heart, a little bit of his light inside him died further when he realized that. It's so adorable.
Yeah, that is exactly what I wanted it to be. Like, I knew he was going to be good in the show because he's like just a good presence in things. But, like, I wanted him to, like, actually be into being in this.
Yeah.
Because whatever you think his reaction to things are going to be, it's never exactly that. And because everyone said, oh, Werner Herzog's he's in Disney. He's going to, like, you know, be grouchy about this or something. And I'm like, no. This is going to be like the corporate side of Hollywood thing that he like grazes up against and decides, no, you know what? I can hang here.
Yeah. There is artistry in the Happy Meal.
I
like, what astounds me, right, is that, like, you have Werner Herzog, Disney have literally all of the money. Werner Herzog is not an expensive filmmaker. Give him, like, $80 million and a Baby Yoda puppet and tell him to do whatever he wants with it, and you will release it on Disney Plus. Let him do his kind of Black is King but with Baby Yoda on Disney Plus. That is all that I want from, like, Disney's Star Wars brand. If they do that, nothing else matters.
Like, that's do it, you cowards.
If this all had happened, like, 7 years ago, like, Disney Plus absolutely would have released that 3D cave movie. There's nothing not Disney-ish about that, and that probably would have been, like, the most profitable documentary thing that he released. For that, which is that if you haven't seen that, that was a trip. I wish they'd re-released that in the 3D, because that was actually one of the best 3D things I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's up there with Avatar in terms of things I actually appreciate in experiencing in three dimensions and reality. Obviously, reality, Avatar, and Cave of Forgotten Dreams. Three of my favorite three-dimensional things.
Yeah, have we seen this, Jack?
No, I have. I don't even know what you're talking about. I haven't heard about it.
Oh
no, this was on the. I think they're closed now. There's the caves in France that they found, like, the, at the time they were the oldest known human cave paintings.
Oh, okay.
That this is when they were about to close them, Werner Herzog took the he got the Avatar 3D cameras, basically. They licensed them out from James Cameron and took I think it was just him and one other guy, because you can't take that many people into these caves because it's a world historic site. And said, okay, no, because part of what's interesting about the cave paintings is that the paintings wrap around the textures of the rocks and stuff, and so, you know, we're gonna shoot the shit out of these things in actual 3D to get the actual documentation of what this looked like before they seal the cave back up so it doesn't fall apart again, and just walked around the cave and shot it and took, you know, 3D images of it. And it's, I mean, it's really, there's not much else to the movie other than Werner Herzog walking around a cave talking about, that is a bison, it's fascinating. And I'm like, yes, it is.
Oh, God. Hold on. I got to open another tab. We got to.
Yeah, it's amazing. And they gave it a, like, big theatrical release. I think, like, museums that had IMAXs played it for years. But it was really something. I mean, yeah, if he'd been working with Disney when that came out, I mean, it's not like Grizzly Man, where they obviously wouldn't have run that.
Right.
Yeah.
No, it did. It actually, ticket sales averaged $25,500 per theater in the opening weekend, which was Herzog's best ever theater opening and the highest per theater average of any film in the U.S. for that weekend as well. It is, if you haven't seen it. My favorite part of that is when they did, remember they were releasing for a little while the animated Disney classics in 3D. So they did, like, what was it? They did, like, The Lion King in 3D and stuff like that. And my favorite part of that was the press tour with Jeremy Irons, who had somebody had strong-armed him into doing press for the re-release, presumably by driving a dump truck full of money up to his house. And he was doing it with James Earl Jones. And James Earl Jones was like, I love this movie. It means so much when people come up to me and I say, you know, Simba. And I watch the reaction of kids, and it genuinely moves me. And it's like they ask, Jeremy Irons, so what do you think of 3D? It's like, well, I saw the Werner Herzog movie, and that was pretty good. And that's it. That was just it. That was his sum total of Jeremy Irons.
By the way, for anyone listening or watching, I know Darren said the title earlier, but it was during a lot of stuff. The Werner Herzog movie is Cave of Forgotten Dreams.
Yeah, worth checking out. Worth checking out. Yeah,
great. Particularly if you have a 3D IMAX.
If you have yes, I have one in the backyard, so don't worry.
It's good. That up. It's good not in 3D, but it's great in 3D.
Yeah. Mm.
And I'm absolutely. There must still be, like, museums that play it in some places, because it was made to be exhibited like that.
So. Yeah.
So now that the Werner Herzog tangent is wrapped up completely, what eccentric filmmaker are they going to cast in season 2? David Lynch?
Oh, that would be so cool.
Wouldn't that be great to see him show up there?
I would be. I don't. Oh, man. I don't know if. Would he do it?
Of course he would. Laura Dern was in The Last Jedi. He would do that. Yeah, Dern would be like, do it, Davey.
Yeah. Because I know I have never had the pleasure, but I have so many colleagues here in Boston who have had the experience of having to like wrangle David Lynch for interviews through, and I've always wanted to, and I've like missed the opportunity, but like everyone has fascinating stories about, you know, dealing with like the most pleasant, genuinely strange person that you can do, who is, he's like kind of so normal that it's weird, you know, that like it would be, because like I've only ever been like in the room, you know, that he's also in, like, I didn't like, oh, hi, Dave, nice to meet you. You know, it was just like, lots of other people in there. But, you know, it's people underestimate, you know, that people think, oh, no, he must be like a genuinely creepy person. Cronenberg is a creepy person not in a bad way, but like if you see him in interviews and stuff, and he is. Yeah, he gives off like when Cronenberg plays like a mad scientist in his own movies, or like in Jason X for some reason.
Why not?
Yeah, right. I think the director was a protege of his, but you can buy that like David Cronenberg would be there. David Lynch, if he wasn't David Lynch, you'd think he was like a youth pastor or something. You know, he just seems like it's like if Ned Flanders was actually Jodorowsky.
And that's what I'm saying. Like like make him like the senator of a little planet and have him just go, Mando, I don't know. I don't know if you can stay here, Mando, you and your fucking baby Yoda. And then, you know, it's perfect.
I mean, he did 3 seasons of The Cleveland Show, so.
Why not?
Yeah.
Yeah, he'll have a great time.
Yeah.
All right. Well, then, wrap up Mandalorian talk. We all seem to be in agreement. They're like, oh, yeah, Mandalorian's good. Yeah. More Mandalorian, great.
I wish there was stuff in the trailer to talk about, but there's mostly like, hey, look, a lady in a robe. That could be literally anyone.
Right.
Do we know, have they said who that is yet? Or it's just, it doesn't appear to have been Rosario Dawson, so it could be anyone.
No. It was a Jedi there. At least the people are reading from the dialogue over that it appears to be a Jedi. I'm going to pitch the director cameo. It should be Martin Scorsese, and he should just walk through the film and through the TV show and go, this is cinema. And that's it. That's all he does.
He doesn't have like a little alien friend that he's saying that to. He just says that like to the camera.
He is Daddy Yoda. I mean, come on, look at Martin Scorsese. He's tiny and he's wise. Tell me you wouldn't believe Martin Scorsese is Daddy Yoda. No, it's Scorsese cameo. He's going to be working a holocron camera somewhere in there, because a Scorsese cameo is always, look at me, I'm a director. So he'll probably be like looking at something and go, this is cinema. That's it. That's your cameo. And have Favreau just kind of go to Kevin Feige and do like,
All right, well then let's move on to, we only have a little bit of time left here. Let's move on to the general reshuffling of things. If in case anyone doesn't know, if you're listening to this podcast in the future, America is still deep in a global pandemic and not making great strides to get out of it. I know it's different things in different countries, but our theaters are more closed than they are open. And so the big tentpole movies from the studios keep getting pushed back, hoping things get better, and then they get pushed back again, and then they get pushed back again. Your Wonder Woman's, your Black Widow's, the Candyman is a remake, right? Not a sequel.
I think it's a legacy sequel. Tony Todd is in there, I believe. Oh, sorry.
I'm sorry. No, go ahead.
I was gonna say, I think Tony Todd has been confirmed as appearing in it, which would suggest it's a legacy sequel. Although they've been playing it relatively close to the chest.
Sure.
In the casting lists, the main young man in the movie has the same name as the baby from the first Candyman, so gotcha. It appears to be a legacy sequel.
So sequel, soft rebooty, legacy. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay. Well, the point is, things keep getting pushed back. Well, a big piece of news that may or may not be news recently was that the Black Widow movie just went to localization, where they take a movie and localize it for different countries, different language interpretations of the movie, which generally means that a movie is about to come out which means that Disney might be trying to pull a Mulan with Black Widow and releasing it globally in theaters and here in America on Disney Plus. Reportedly, Mulan, Disney, while not happy with how Mulan is doing around the world, is very happy with how it performed on Disney Plus.
Well, to be fair, there are a number of like competing different demands on it. Like, it's because they're so vague and oblique, you're getting different people giving you different results. I think Yahoo Finance reported that it made $260 million in its opening week, which is bigger than any movie at the box office, even before the pandemic, like this year so far. But then you look at things like, say, Antenna looking at numbers, you look at numbers like Sign Up and stuff like that, and you see that like the figures, depending on who's looking at them and who's reading them, they're either very disappointing, perfectly okay, or absolutely amazing. And, you know, again, because I tend to work on the assumption that, generally speaking, if numbers are good, studios will get out there and trumpet them, particularly when they are studios in need of good PR. As, let's face it, Disney would really like to have been talking about anything except the Chinese cinematic release of Mulan this past week. And similar to, like, when Trolls happened with Universal, Universal got out immediately and said, we made as much on video on demand with this movie as we did with the original in theaters. What I think is interesting is that, again, Tenet released in cinemas, it did not do well in the States, to put it mildly. What's interesting is that it seems to have done relatively well internationally. It's already grossed more than, I think, Dunkirk in Germany, for example. It's done as well as most of Nolan's movies, with the exception of Interstellar in China, where, in fact, it's actually outgrossed Mulan, I think, in terms of China. So it's on the road, in theory, to profitability, as much as anybody can measure profitability in this. I think it's because of the extra share that Warners are taking, I think 63% of the box office. It's estimated that to break even, Warners need to make somewhere between $400 million and $450 million, which is a lot more doable than I would have guessed that it would have been when it first released. But the problem is that its release in the States bombed, and there's no signal that Mulan kind of like set Disney's servers on fire. So otherwise you'd be hearing a lot more about people going direct to video. So theaters know based on the results that you got from Tenet. And like the IndieWire article on the release of Tenet in the States is heartbreaking to read, but a necessary read. It basically says that like cinemas, in order to reopen to hold Tenet, are actually running at a loss because there's no other product to go there and nobody's attending them. They were screwed beforehand, but because Tenet is the only release there and nobody's going to it, they're even more screwed afterwards as a result as well. So any studio with a lick of sense has immediately gone, no more theatrical releases for the foreseeable future of anything that needs to make any money whatsoever. So, you know, for example, you mentioned that like Warner Brothers immediately moved Wonder Woman back to Christmas, which presumably means that Dune is out of 2020 and into 2021. Candyman has been pushed into 2021, for example, and various other movies have been moved around as well. It's worth noting that movies that don't need to do well in the States are actually feeling a bit more bullish after Tenet came out. So St. Maud, which is a really great British horror, for example, is going to be coming out for Halloween over here. We're seeing our cinemas reopening. And there's a sense in which, like, again, cinema in Asia as well is also doing very well, local Chinese blockbusters and things like that as well. The problem is for American studios, there is no right answer. You can't put it, you literally can't put anything in cinemas between now and 2021, mid-2021 if you're being honest, or it will make a loss. From the look of Mulan, if Mulan had made money, you would have immediately seen Disney go bullish on it. You would have seen announcements that, oh yeah, this model was great, as opposed to the press from Disney on Mulan was the same as the press from Warner Brothers on Tenet, which is, we're very happy with how this film is doing. Don't ask any further questions about it. But like if premium video on demand worked, you'd see more studios going. You see Universal going, put Candyman on video on demand. Or, you know, put Promising Young Woman on video on demand. If like there was a way that they could make money back there. And it's notable that like Universal, who led the video on demand charge, like when the pandemic broke, Universal immediately put on The Invisible Man on demand. They immediately put Emma on demand. They immediately put The Hunt on demand. And they've since put like The King of Staten Island on demand as well. And like they were the ones who wanted to do it with Tower Heist back in 2010. And it's notable that there has been radio silence from Universal in terms of what else they're going to put on video on demand, which would lead me to believe that the numbers for things that are not Trolls, and I think that like Trolls is an exceptional case because if you're locked in a house with a bunch of kids who desperately need entertainment, there is no option except buying Trolls, as opposed to something like Mulan, where it's like, will I pay $30 or will I just watch The Devil All the Time? The Devil All the Time may be crap, but I don't have to pay $30 for it. So yeah, this is the kind of like the really awful situation. Well, I mean, I say really awful situation. Like, there are really terrible situations in this pandemic. This doesn't even rank in the top 20, top 30, top 40, to be absolutely clear. But like, for cinemas, this and for like studios and for people whose livelihoods depend on cinemas and movie making, this is the worst case scenario. There is no way to have a big budget movie make a profit or turn a profit between now and, if we're being honest, I'm going to say 2021, mid-2021.
Oh, at least, like, because like, you're not only dealing with, you know, clearing up the pandemic, but then you're dealing with the psychological problem of convincing people it's okay to sit in a room. Back out again. Absolutely. And, you know, we've been dealing with this on all sorts of different levels, of just convincing people when it's okay, that it's okay. And that's going to be a whole nother issue. I know our theaters here in America, or at least in Wisconsin where I am, they tried opening at a reduced capacity. And of course, we have a mask mandate here. And so the idea would be, yes, you're inside. Yes, it's recycled air, but reduced capacity and everyone's wearing a mask. So it should be okay. And no one turned out.
Yeah.
Our drive-ins, though, while we can still have them and while we still have nice weather, have been seeing record numbers because people feel safe going to them. Yeah. So a lot of older movies, a lot of releases, newer releases are actually going to drive-ins.
I've been to a drive-in. It's actually really, really good. I went to see Wolf of Wall Street of all movies in a drive-in. It's like being in the 50s, but with more sex on screen, more cocaine, I suspect.
Yeah. And so, you know, part of it is going to be a changing paradigm to get people's butts back into seats when it's safe. Please let's wait until it's safe.
Yeah.
And the other part of it is shifting, like, you know, with something like Wonder Woman and Candyman, I think that's a little easier. It would have been nice to have that before Halloween, but that's also, those are just kind of one-off movies. In a case like Black Widow, that is a piece of a machine that is currently running, like WandaVision, Winter Soldier, Falcon Winter Soldier, plus the slew of the next Marvel movies all have to line up after Black Widow. So the delay of that is also delaying the rest of the machine, which is why probably Disney is looking at video on demand options just to keep the machine running.
Yeah. And also, they have to get product out. I mean, they are like Disney is hemorrhaging money. Disney has a lot. I mean, they can afford to. they can really afford to, but they are losing money. They've, you know, it's their public relations control is really good, and they've been able to, you know, like those parks are opened back up. They really shouldn't be. Like the people have been dragging every other industry that has opened back up unsafely over the coals. The Disney having reopened the theme parks kind of stopped being a page one story because Disney can do that. And also they're doing either a decent enough job keeping people quiet or a decent enough job actually keeping things manageable, that there aren't like a million stories of coronavirus outbreaks in, I mean, one of the parks is in Florida. So how likely is that? I don't know.
But we're getting more stories of like, you know, weddings spreading coronavirus than we are getting, stories of Disneyland golf club dinners.
Right. Yeah. So who knows, but, I am deeply cynical about the, about how much longer the general public and the industry is actually going to continue behaving itself. I think people have been better and worse than I would have given them credit for. Because on the one hand, if you had told me like at the beginning of this, that like the people marching through Target to spit on people would be a thing. Like, I would have believed you, but I still would have been surprised.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, if you told me that the theater that they opened Tenet and people didn't rush the theater just to prove that they could, because Americans doing stupid, dangerous things just to prove that we feel invincible is literally our other national pastime. Watch Class Action Park. I actually can't believe that someone without passing a law said, don't do this, it's dangerous, and people went, yeah, okay. And it actually blows my mind. Mm-hmm. So who knows? But I think if it was Black Widow or Wonder Woman instead of Tenet, it might be different. But who knows? I don't know how much longer it can continue pushing. Mm-hmm. And I have I think that right now what is keeping a lot of the tension going is a vague sense that there is no plan long term right now, because everyone expects the plan to change in 40 days when we know who's going to be president for the next 4 years.
Right.
And that right now there isn't one, because everyone knows that one way or another, there could be a completely different plan for how to manage all of the health stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully a very different one. But either way, a different one. And I think that should Joe Biden become president, that was a finger crossing sign, by the way, guys. I didn't salute the camera. That was a hopeful thing. But
I will. Yeah, I'll be hopeful.
Yeah.
I'll go full hope. Yeah.
If that happens, I have a feeling that the sense of relief felt by many people mm-hmm. will be, and this is me being a cynical guy, will be followed by a lot of people going suddenly, well, one horrible thing is taken care of, ergo that me. I think Donald Trump and the virus are connected in a lot of people's minds, like psychologically, mm-hmm. and that if one goes away, for a lot of people, psychologically, will begin acting like both of them have gone away. And for better or for worse, they'll start demanding, mm-hmm. nope, hey, the thing I've associated with the virus is gone. That means I can stop wearing my mask. And that means, mm-hmm. hey, let me in. Like, the thing that's been keeping liberals behaving themselves is they're going to stop.
Well, on a more positive note, I'm going to try to spin that in a more positive direction.
I'm sorry.
You're right to be cynical. Absolutely. But also, like, society only exists because of confidence in the system. And right now, there ain't a lot of confidence in the system. So a change of guard could mean a general relief of, oh, the system will stay in place, and that could lead to some good things.
That is so much the nicer version of what I meant. Go with that.
That's what I'm going to believe. I'm going to believe that there's going to be a general, like, oh wait, people actually know what they're doing now, so I should really follow these rules because people know what they're doing. And that's what I'm gonna. That's the hope I'm going to keep in my heart.
Me too.
Great. Let's see if we can wrap this up into some thoughts. So are we going to see more things release on video on demand just to try to get some sort of revenue, or is it going to be a constant shell game of moving it back? What are our thoughts there?
I think Soul is going to video on demand. I think that's pretty much a guarantee. Yeah. Disney is going to release Soul on there, in large part because we've seen that animated movies like Trolls do very, very well there. Stuff like Warner Brothers mm-hmm. releasing Scoob on there seemed to work relatively well for them. Even Artemis Fecking Fowl seemed to at least kind of garner some attention when it went on Disney Plus. So I think that you will mm-hmm. see that going there. And there's been some suggestion, I think, that Universal, ironically, have moved the Croods into the theatrical release corridor that was reserved for Soul. So, like, I think that there's some mumbling happening behind the scenes that Soul will be going on video on demand. Outside of that, adult films, the indie developers are like the indie studios and are doing remarkably well in terms of getting stuff online. The best releases of the pandemic have arguably been from independent distributors, IFC and stuff like that. That's why you've seen so much great horror there. Mm-hmm. Stuff like, say, you know, I really like James Franco's The Rental, for example, but even things like The Assistant, which was, again, a kind of a Sundance favorite last year, but released quietly on video on demand. So I think you'll see those going there. I don't think you'll see, I would be surprised if you see that many big budget movies going there. I don't know. I would be surprised if Black Widow does without having a theatrical release overseas. I wonder if Black Widow might get a video on demand release for the American market and then an international release, but an international release for other countries that already have Disney Plus. So like for Ireland, where I have Disney Plus, I wonder if Disney won't release that in cinemas in the hope that it will do more there than it would on video on demand. So I kind of wonder if you'll see like a two-track system where you'll see movies being released in video on demand on the States and then in cinemas internationally. But again, it's far too early to say, I think.
That's fair.
Yeah, I think we're coming up on rock and a hard place for a lot of these things. And I agree with Darren. I think that you're going to start seeing on demand in the United States and theatrical everywhere else. I think Soul is going to go to Disney Plus. And I think that the only reason you haven't heard the announcement on Soul already is Disney has not yet figured out which other movie that is not the first Black Pixar movie that they're going to put out along with it, so that it doesn't look as bad that they're sending the first Black Pixar movie directly to video. Which is, by the way, the reason that half of these things haven't already been shipped out is because this was like the big... the summer of female-led and person of color-led movies that all got pushed ahead. Other, like, if this wasn't Wonder Woman, Black Widow, Soul, and all of these other movies, they'd already be half of them on demand. You know, it was like this was the year every other franchise caught up with Fast and Furious, and everyone it was like, well, nothing can get in the way of this, and then it turned out the universe is a racist.
Well, I think that's a lovely note to leave on.
Yeah, aren't I a barrel of sunshine this week?
That's just a great joke. So, thank you all for listening and or watching this, the Escapist Movie Podcast. Once again, I've been Jack Packard.
I'm Bob Chipman.
Darren Mooney.
And we will see you, or you will hear us, next week. Bye.